I do not do work.
Next year?
Yeah.
I don't know that. It kind of depends on what kind of sign-up we get. Usually, in the past, we've taken about a year's break, you know, between the... That's what's happened in the past, just because it's been hard to get that many to sign up. Yeah.
Hebrew orientation. Not a chance.
Right.
A couple guys said they want to take it.
Good. Well, if so, it's simply a matter of economics. I think if they have enough to sign up, we'll start a new one next year.
This keeps going. I'll learn Greek and Hebrew pretty well every year. Never get a chance to let it get cold. Okay. Today we're looking at Lesson 38, doing review here again. And I'm going to start slowing down on review a little bit in these next couple of chapters on questions and relative clauses, because much of what we're going to be doing this year is going to involve a lot of these kinds of things, and I want to make sure that we have this real down real well. And, of course, we're going to be, the rest of this, finishing out the rest of the book, is going to be dealing with a lot more of these types of clause relationships, relative clauses, questions, this type of thing. So we want to be sure that we've got that down real well. So we're on Lesson 38 on the negatives. And as I mentioned yesterday, this lesson is largely an inductive one, so most of your real answers to the questions are found in your exercises. And so if you want to review those exercises on this, that would be helpful as well. In the exercises, basically what we had here in the chapter was a whole series of sentences with the English translations. And then the exercises involved inspecting those to ascertain what kinds of negatives are being used in different situations. And basically it turns out that the negatives that are used with the verb forms of the indicative mood, in other words, when you have a verb form in the indicative mood, the kind of a negative you'll have is an ooh type negative. And if it's just simply a not, it'll be ooh. If it's no longer, uketi, not yet, it'll be upo or udepo. Never is udepotev. No one is udes, and nothing is uden. So you have a whole series of forms with ooh that are used with the indicative mood. Then, if your sentence has a participle, or let me put it this way, if the negative is applied to an infinitive or a participle, then you use a form of may. And you have essentially the same kind of words, except we have may for not, may keti, may po, or may depote, may des, may den. Same kind of words, only with may now. And so that's the basic observation. Now, there were a little bit more refinements. The form uk with a kappa instead of the form u will occur before a word that begins with a vowel that has a smooth breathing. If the vowel has a rough breathing, then it'll have the form uk with a chi in the end. So you just see some variant forms of the word u before certain types of words. And you have a double negative, as it were, u may, with the active indicative expresses a strong negative. So you get a very strong negative sense if you use ume, and this is all coming from the exercises. These are just observations you made in your exercise 38A. So if you didn't bring your exercise book with you, if you've got it, you can take a look at that and just make some observations there. That's essentially what this chapter is all about. So that exercise 38A really is your synopsis of the grammar in chapter 38. And two or more negatives in the same construction reinforce each other. They don't cancel each other out. That's the unusual thing about Greek. So it's a different language, and it's got a different type of approach to this. So double negative is really an intense negative in Greek. Okay, now there will be a combination may, u, that we're going to get to when we deal with questions. But u, may, you'll see u first, then may. That's your double negative. Yes, Greg?
Okay, that's what I was wondering, because they seem to have kind of a distinction here between u, may, and then double negative. But u, may is always a double negative.
Right. Yeah.
Not like may, or something like that.
Right. Yeah, it'll always be u, may for your double negative. It won't be may, or it won't be u, u. It'll be u, may. And then you'll see a combination may, u sometimes. That's relatively rare, but it's when you're asking a question that expects a negative answer and you have a negative within the question also. So that's we'll get to that in the next chapter. I'll kind of save that. That's fortunately, it doesn't occur very often. You find your brain has to do several transformations, you know, to try to figure out what you're saying. Okay. That's about it on this chapter then. And there's some remarks in section 298 here. As far as declensions are concerned, maybe we should just take a quick look at those. It forms udes and medes, which would mean no one, either for, and udes would be no one for when you're using it with the indicative, and medes is no one when you're using it with the participles and infinitives. They're declined like heis, so it's just basically putting u and then the delta and then ace, the same thing. You don't have the rough reading anymore, but the declension is just the same. So you can just see the quick model for the paradigm on that. Neither one of them has plural forms, of course, since you're dealing with no one. The word for one doesn't have any plural forms. Other negatives, we have upo and mapo that were mentioned, meaning not yet. Udepo and medepo, also meaning not yet, just longer forms. Uthes and methes are alternate forms of udes and medes, so you may run into those forms once in a while. Uhi and u with the accent are words regularly used for no. So if you want to say no, if you respond no, it would be u with an accent, and or uhi, a little bit longer form. And then uhi also may be used as a simple negative in the place of u in some situations. The question, of course, is there more emphasis when you see that form? And probably slightly more. Usually if something's longer and so forth, and you're spending more time saying it, and it's going to get a little bit more emphasis, especially when you could use a shorter word. Okay, so that's about it for that chapter. It's not too difficult a chapter, really. Main distinction, then, is to note that u is going with your indicative forms and me is going with your participles or infinitives when you're trying to negate something. Okay, then chapter 39 is dealing with questions. And this really isn't that difficult a chapter. There's a few, about, I think maybe the most difficult thing to remember is this deal with introducing a question with u and me and remembering which kind of question, which kind of answer is being asked for. That's about the only part that's really that much different than English. Another thing, too, is that the interrogative pronoun declines in Greek, whereas in English it doesn't. So let's look at chapter 39 here. He gives an introduction here just talking about questions in general, saying that in English they're indicated primarily by special intonation patterns. And then there are also certain other types of words also that work. It's mainly intonation pattern in English that will determine a question. But there are also secondary things. You see, in English you can say even a statement and put a different intonation pattern on it and make a question out of it. But then there's also other ways to make questions, and the same is true in Greek. Now, in Greek, we don't know what the intonation patterns were, especially since the punctuation was missing in the Anzio manuscripts. So there are some potential problems when you're dealing with Greek as to whether something's a question or a statement, and that has generated some differences of opinion, of course, in commentaries and so forth, and translations on certain passages. But by and large, there are indicators both in Greek and in English to show whether you're dealing with a question or not. So section 300 here deals with, in English, other ways besides intonation pattern that will indicate that a question is being asked. The first one is word order. And, for example, you have a statement, "You are king of the Jews," and then you can make that a question by reversing the "you" and the "are." And place the "are" first, place the verb first, and then the subject. "Are you king of the Jews?" So that's a very common way to make a question in English, is to reverse the order of the subject and the verb. So word order variation. You could, of course, make the statement, "You are king of the Jews," by changing the intonation pattern. You could still get a question. "You are king of the Jews." You could make a question out of it also by changing intonation pattern or changing word order. Then the second category here is the use of auxiliary verbs as function words. Statement, "He thinks so." Question, "Does he think so?" Notice the word "does" there is an auxiliary verb, and in this case the word "does" has other functions, but in this case it's indicating a question. And then thirdly, the use of other interrogative function words. First, you have pronouns, "Who do you think you are?" or "Whom do you wish to see?" "Whose dog are you?" "What is the matter?" "What is the matter?" There you see various forms of And these almost look like they have case endings on them. I mean, and some suggest that this is a remnant of ancient English, you know, case endings, because languages like German, for example, have case endings. So who do you think you are? There the question is, the who is functioning as a subject. Whom do you wish to see? There it's functioning as a direct object. Whose dog are you? Is functioning as a genitive, as it were, a possessive. What is the matter? There you have the subject position again. Only now it's dealing with a thing, neuter kind of an idea rather than person. Then we have adjectives. Which way did he go? And why would we call that an adjective? Well, it's modifying the idea of way. Which way? It's a, you know, just like any other adjective that might modify a noun. Only this time it's an interrogative adjective, and it's asking a question. It's asking for information to fill in the kind of adjective that describes the way that he went. Adverbs, where do you think you're going? It's indicating place. When does the next swan leave? And where you got that sentence? And how do you get that way? All of those are adverbial ideas. So there is a number of sets of words in English that are very unambiguous as to indicating questions. Now, of course, clause constructions and so forth are necessary too. These same words, which, what, where, and so forth, also have other functions in the language depending upon the word order and other things in English. And we'll find a parallel to that in Greek as well. Although in Greek, the situation is a little bit easier because we have a different paradigm for the relative pronoun and for the interrogative pronoun, which is kind of nice. Now, section 301 begins to talk about the Greek mechanisms. Some of the secondary means for indicating questions in Greek are, as we have said, similar to those found in English. It should be noticed, however, that word order is not among these. So again, word order is not functioning in Greek the way it is in English. So you're not going to be able to make a question in Greek just by changing the word order, because they change the word order for, the word order is not fixed anyway. So changing word order in Greek isn't usually going to make much of a difference at all. Maybe make a slight difference in emphasis, but it won't turn a statement into a question. A Greek sentence which contains none of the secondary question indicators which we shall describe may be either a question or a statement, regardless of word order. In interpreting it as one or the other, we must be guided by the context. So sometimes we have to just go by context. The word order is not going to make a difference. So we find, example, Mark 15:2, su eho basileus ton eudaion. This could be rendered as a question, are you king of the Jews? Or it could be rendered a statement, you are king of the Jews. And it's rendered as a question simply because it's of the context, and Pontius Pilate would not be likely to be saying, you are king of the Jews, and making an acknowledgement of that. And so in that, because of the context, it would be taken as a question. There are some situations, though, where it fits either way in the context, and that's where the biggest disagreements lie. So he gives an example here where the editors themselves are in disagreement. Some texts will put a question mark, some won't. John 16:31, arti pistuae, do you now believe? Although some editors have said, you believe now, making a statement out of it. So those are some instances where it's worthy of doing some exploration into the context and other things, and considering your options when you find a situation like that. Okay, then section 302. Here we look at into the Greek use of function words to indicate questions, and here we need to note, first of all, this first situation is slightly different than what we have in English. In the first example here, we see may, when used with the indicative mood, introduces a question to which a negative answer is expected. Now notice this is may used with the indicative mood. Now earlier in the previous chapter, we saw may used with participles and infinitives as a normal, just an ordinary negative. Now when you see may used with an indicative mood, it's not a negative anymore. It's indicating a question to which a negative answer is expected. The idea of negativeness is still involved in a sense, but it's asking a question to which a negative answer is expected. Now, that kind of information usually comes in English from the word order and intonation patterns. We can get that kind of, we can ask a question to which a negative answer is expected in English, but we don't do it by using a particular word. We do it with intonation patterns and word order. So here an example, not John 9:40, me hemes tu phloesmen, are we blind? Are we blind? And the expected answer is no. In other words, it's kind of leading. In Greek, when you ask a question, you usually lead the person. You're trying to elicit a certain response. Now, bear in mind that simply because a question is asked a certain way does not mean that the answer is going to be a no answer, for example, here. It just means that that's what the person who's asking the question expects. So there's an indication of the expectation on the part of the person who's asking it. It doesn't necessarily mean, however, that the answer to the question is, in fact, no. It may, in fact, be yes, but it's not expected to be such. Okay, I'm not sure what the context of this. I think it's when Jesus healed the blind man, and it's referring to the what?
The Pharisees.
Yeah, the Pharisees are saying this. Are we blind? And in effect, they were expecting a no answer, but in reality, the answer was yes. Yes.
Now, how would you translate the way that are we blind, or what's in the parentheses?
Well, that's a good question. I think I would probably, if there's sufficient context to make it real clear, you can probably get by with just saying, are we blind? That's probably all you need if the context is sufficient. If there's any doubt about it, though, or if you're trying to make a special point in the exegesis, then I would maybe go to something like, we aren't blind, are we? It makes it a little bit more unambiguous that they really genuinely are expecting a no answer. So I'm not too worried about it if the context is pretty tight, but if the context isn't really showing you that clearly what's going on, the Greek use of may will. And so you want to make sure that that gets transmitted into your translation so that the reader doesn't have any question about it. In other words, translate in such a way that there's no question in the reader's mind that a no answer is expected.
Actually, if you were going word for word, neither one of these would do. It would be, we aren't blind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's about all you're going to have is in Greek, we aren't blind, and then with intonation pattern. We aren't blind, you know. Yeah,
English.
Right. That's our problem, you see. The problem is going from Greek to English and trying to set up in English a construction that will transmit the information. And so that's why the translation in parentheses there, so that you try to get this real clear idea that no answer is expected. Yes.
That's one thing that was bothering me about questions. Why? In English, questions are simple because of basically, the word orders.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking, what is the question? It's more like, it's basically it's just a declaration that demands a response.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all you've got here is that not us were
mm-hmm.
blind.
Mm-hmm.
Well, come on, respond to this.
Right. Right, and in English, the intonation pattern is kind of doing that. It's leading to a response. It's kind of picking the thing right up and leaving it in the person's lap, you know, and now he's got to respond. And the same thing is happening in Greek, it's just that it's not being done the same way. Now, one of your indicators here is having may with an indicative verb form. That is going to transmit information immediately, because normally may is not used with indicative verb form, so you're going to see that. And I would guess, too, I mean, realistically, there was probably intonation pattern as well. We just don't know what the intonation patterns were for Koine Greek. And we can't be sure that modern Greek has the same intonation patterns. We could look at modern Greek and see what they are, but that may not be a reliable indicator of what the intonation patterns were in Koine Greek. And so we have to kind of... You know, fortunately, Greek has some other indications in here, and we'll use those. And then, having seen those in English, we'll use intonation patterns we normally do to express questions, regardless of word order and other things too. Okay. Another example, at the top of the next page: Me pontes glossais lalousen. Do all speak with tongues? Again, we have me with an indicative verb form, and so the expected answer is no. Do all speak with tongues? No. Or all do not speak with tongues? Do they? And that kind of wording, all do not speak with tongues, do they, it kind of puts the question in a statement form almost to kind of project that intended answer into the person who's making the response. So you can see there's kind of an expectation of a no answer again. And then there's a longer form, Métis, in addition to May, that's used less frequently, has the same meaning. Steve, before we go.
Would you say in general that these always introduce a sentence like this?
Yes, as far as the question, when you see May, I don't know if it gives any exceptions to that. See, it may not be the very first thing in the sentence, but it may be if there's a quotation or something that says, and Jesus said, or something like that, then you might see it not right at the very first of the sentence, but the beginning of the actual statement of the question. Mm-hmm. But I think that generally that's going to be the case. You're going to see it right in the beginning, because it's going to be an indicator of something. Mm-hmm. And the same with ooh, when it's used to introduce questions. And it's expecting an affirmative answer. So it, right at the beginning of the question part of it, at least, is where you're going to see this. Was there a question back here?
In the comment, they keep using the word introduce a question.
Right. I can't imagine. See, if it comes later, then if you've got ooh, for example, if it comes later, it's going to be usually taken as a negative. If it's may and it comes later, see, may would be possible to even understand it as a question, even if it came later, because may with the indicative, you see, would be something strange. But I don't think you're going to see it that way. It really is introducing something. It's setting the person's mind immediately. Now I've got a question. I'm getting a question. So I think that's probably going to be the case. I can't think of any exceptions to it. Okay. So we see this alternate form, Métis instead of May. Don't need to go through all the examples there, but it's the same meaning. Okay, now part three here. And its alternate forms, ook and ook, and sometimes uhi. Introduce questions to which an affirmative answer is expected. Again, the idea of introducing is seen here. And here we're expecting an affirmative answer. We're expecting a yes answer. Now, of course, the word ooh means no, just like the word may means no in certain, when it's used in other ways. But here, we're translating utos estinho to tectonos huios. Isn't this the son of the carpenter? Okay, now the question in English can be put into a negative format. Isn't this the son of the carpenter? And the answer is expected is yes, it is the son of the carpenter. Or this is the son of the carpenter, isn't it? This is the son of the carpenter, isn't it? And the expected answer is yes. You're expecting an affirmation of that, of the allegation here. And a couple more examples along the same line. So. Who use when you expect an affirmative answer, may use when you expect a negative answer. Now, remark one here, who and its variant forms need not introduce questions, of course, especially when they immediately precede the verb in a sentence. They may simply be negatives. So we can see that who is not always a question introducer. May usually will be, but who can also be the negative. And it's possible to have the negative in the first position also. So we have to be a little careful there. Because we see an ooh in the first position of the sentence doesn't necessarily mean that it's introducing question. Of course, ooh will be seen later on in sentences also just before the verb. Usually, see, ooh will be just before the verb form if it's trying to negate the verb form. And if that happens to come right at the beginning, then we could either have, we might have an ambiguity there. We might have a possibility of looking at it as either a question or as a statement, a negative statement. Mm-hmm. Yes, right. Yeah. He doesn't really make a point of that here, but that's generally going to be the case. We will get into things where we get into subjunctives and so forth, but not so much with questions, because a question is, the very nature of a question is indicative mood. It's petitioning information. And, you know, the issue is information, and that's what the indicative is, you know, the whole indicative mood is about. There are things that are something analogous. When we get into the subjunctive, when you're starting talking about possibilities and so forth, you get some things analogous to questions, but they're not so direct, straightforward, asking information type of things. And we'll be getting into those later on. Okay, now here's an example, ook emi apostolos. Since the ooh comes out in front of the verb here, that could either be just the negative of the verb and be a statement, I am not an apostle. Or it could be a question, am I not an apostle? So again, you have to look at context to decide the issue. Then remark two, may and ooh occur together in this order. Remember we had ooh may before in the previous chapter as a double negative. Here we have may and ooh occur in this order. May introduces the question and ooh has its ordinary negative force. So may is introducing a question to which a negative response is expected. Then you have an ooh that will negate the verb, and this makes for a kind of an interesting question. For example, here we have may uk ekusan. Have they not heard? Well, what they're asking, have they not heard, is expecting a no answer. No, they haven't not heard, as it were. In other words, yes, they have heard. See, when you negate, you might think of it this way. May is asking for a no answer. But then when you put the ooh in there to negate the statement, what you're really asking for is a yes answer. That is a no answer to the no part of the question, or what ends up being a yes answer. So you do get this kind of a negative, negating a negative idea in this kind of construction. So another way to word the question would be, they haven't not heard, or they haven't, they have heard, haven't they? Or they haven't not heard, have they? That's kind of the literal idea. They haven't not heard, have they? Because again, the uk in front of ekusan. So the may is saying they haven't, and then uk is saying not heard. They haven't not heard, or have they not heard? So it gets kind of twists your tongue and mind up after a while, you're trying to analyze a question like this. But I think you just need to break it down into what's happening. Consider the may as asking for a negative answer, and then consider the ooh as negating the statement, which is then going to make the whole thing really be asking for a yes answer to that simple statement, or a no answer to the negative part of the statement. I don't know if that helps or not. You may just have to read that through a few times and convince yourself of what's going on. Fortunately, this is going to occur very frequently. I don't know how many times, but it doesn't occur, you know, all the time. Yes.
I was wondering. We've got. I'm looking at Ume on page 227.
Mm-hmm.
And that's example number 8 up at the top. That ume is in the indicative mood.
Mm-hmm.
So that may is stuck in there in the indicative mood, but it's not a question because it's not really kind of.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so why couldn't you have ume as a question if that was a participle or an infinitive by the may being, you know, negating the
mm-hmm.
infinitive, and then u negating, negating the verb, so that you have u and then may in
mm-hmm.
the structure of the sentence.
Okay. Well, I think the answer to that is that if it's a participle or an infinitive, it's not the main verb in the sentence. In other words, if you've got a participle or infinitive construction within a sentence, there will also be a finite verb in there someplace. Or either that, or there'll be a predication or something, or, you know, a verb to be understood or something like that. And that is going to be the verb that around which a question has to be based. See, a question is going to be based on the indicative verb in the sentence. There won't be a question about a subordinate clause that contains a participle or something like that. That's not where your questions come in. So I think that would be just resolved by the fact that you would never see a construction like that where a question was being based on a participle or infinitive. It might be possible in a very, you know, poetic, you know, in a real, you know, you think of things like to be or not to be or something like that. You know, this kind of, you know, not very common language where you might be generating a question by not even making a full statement in English. But other than something like that, I don't think you'd ever see a situation where you'd have a question generated, because the question is going to be focusing on the finite verb in the sentence, not on an infinitive or a participle. So I don't think you'd see a construction like that would ever come arise. You would always analyze those as double negative or something. You saw ume in association with something like that. Okay. Then there's a fourth section down here, I guess, at the very bottom. The particle ara, sometimes accompanied by the particle get, introduces a question. It usually indicates impatience or anxiety on the part of the speaker. So they'll say ara. and just and then make a make, make their question. Ara hirese tain piston epites gates. Will he find faith upon the earth? And there's kind of an urgency to it. And it's something more that better felt than telt kind of thing. You see, it's a word that's very hard to translate. To find an equivalent for ara or ara ge is really hard to do. You can't, where do you find a word that you know indicates excitement or something? But it's and it's things like that that sometimes are really difficult. You can't really translate it real easily. But if you're reading it, you could put intonation in that would suggest that. So, indicating a bit of impatience or anxiety or urgency or that type of thing. Okay, then section 303. Greek has interrogative pronouns, adjectives, and adverbs whose meanings and functions are quite similar to those of English. First of all, the interrogative pronoun. Now remember, we saw this section is analogous to what you saw back there on page 228 at the bottom and the top of 229, where using interrogative function words, interrogative pronouns in English, who do you think you are, whom do you wish to see, etc. Now the Greek way to do that is to use this particle tis, and it has a declension, of course, just like anything, almost anything in Greek, and especially since it's going to function in different positions in the sentence. So you have one word, tis or tis. You could be pronounced that way with the accent, but usually it's the circumflex is only when that happens, and it's I've always heard it pronounced tis, although the accent is there, and that's something to observe in all of the forms. Note, if you want to remember where the accent is on this one, just put it on the iota in all the forms, and you'll have it. So throughout the paradigm, it's always on the iota, regardless of whether that's or whether it's got one or two syllables. But the declension of that is just a pretty straightforward third declension form for your masculine feminines and then for your neuters also. Same form for masculine and feminine and slightly different form for neuters, at least in the accusatives and nominatives. Now these forms correspond to English who, whom, whose, which, what, depending on the case, number, and gender of the Greek word to which they refer. So they can be any of those words depending on whether they're subject of the sentence, object of the sentence, genitive phrase, indirect object, whether it's masculine, feminine, or neuter. So here are some examples. Matthew 28:48. I don't know if I'll read all through these, but just to show you the difference here. First, this first example is using tis esten he meter mu, kai tinis esen hoi adel foi mu. Now tis and tinis are both in the nominative case. First, the tis is a nominative form which is actually feminine here. Of course, the feminine and the masculine forms are the same. But since he's asking who is my mother, and mother is feminine, you would probably analyze this as feminine. Although, like I say, the form's the same. And who are my brothers? They're tines. You've got your masculine plural form. And what you're asking, the thing that you're asking about is the subject of the sentence, as it is. This is a predicate construction with a verb to be. And so these would have to be in the nominative case. Now, John 18:4, tina zetete, whom do you seek? Now, in this case, tina would be what case?
Accusative.
Okay. So the thing that's being asked, whom do you seek? You are seeking whom? In other words, the object, the word whom here is receiving the action of being sought. And so it's going to be in the accusative case. Tinos he ekon aute, whose is this image? Well, tinos is genitive. And so what you're really asking is the image of who, the image of whom, or the image of whom, I guess it would be of whom, is this. Whose image is this? Who does this image belong to, you see? It's got that idea of possession, and that's indicated by the genitive. Tini homoioso tain geneon tautain, to what shall I compare this generation? Okay, to what shall I compare it? There's an indirect object sense. And so we have the dative. So in other words, the point is that the case and number and gender of the form of the relative pronoun is going to be selected based on how it's functioning within a sentence and what it's referring to, what its antecedent is, or what you're really expecting to fit into that position. Tis usually begins a sentence or clause, but need not do so, as the last example shows. So su tis a, for example, who are you? Is a case in which tis doesn't begin the sentence, but normally it will. Yes?
Mm-hmm.
somebody, you know, to create the initial ordinance, just these three examples that are.
Okay, that, and that's the only ones in the Bible?
Yeah.
In the New Testament?
Yeah.
Very interesting. Yes, we'll get to that later. It's got a different function as far as the particle is concerned, but as far as questions are concerned, it's,
yeah,
these are the only three. That's interesting. Well, it'd be rather difficult to formulate a very broad general statement about it if there's only three examples. Yeah.
So, if you see R, it's not necessarily just a question.
No, there'll be other uses of it.
If you see it, therefore it's a question.
Oh, yes, that's kind of the way it will introduce a question, but it doesn't necessarily mean that if R is used, there's a question. In other words, it's one of the words that can introduce a question, just like ooh can introduce a question, but ooh may also be a negative. So ara may also be something else. Words like that we put into a category called particles because we don't know what else to do with them. Okay. Then adjectives. These are interrogative adjectives now. On the next page, the pronoun tis may be used adjectively, and in addition, the adjectives poios, which or what kind of, posos, how many, how much, and pelikos, how great, occur in the New Testament. So here are interrogative adjectives that are asking something about the thing that would modify a noun. So here's an example. Tis is used adjectively sometimes. Tina misthon eketa, what reward do you have? So what we're asking for is something about the reward. Now, and as an adjective, of course, it's going to agree with its noun. So the gender and the case number and gender is going to be determined by the noun. Misthon here is rewards in the accusative case, so masculine, so it's tina, tina, tina misthon echete. What reward do you have? Probably won't see tis used as often this way as it is in the other ways, but it'll usually be unambiguous. There won't be any problem in identifying it. Now we have another adjective, poios. What kind of? So poio somati erchontai. With what kind of body do they come? With what kind of body? So we have a dative idea here, and probably many would analyze this as an instrumental dative, although we'll get into those kind of distinctions later on. Or it could be a dative of manner, you know, in what kind of, in what manner. But the idea of what kind of is seen here. Notice that somati is dative singular, so poio is going to be dative masculine singular or neuter singular here. Poia entole megale in tonomu, tonomo, which is the great commandment in the law? So which here is modifying commandment. Which commandment is great in the law? That's kind of the idea. And posos, how many loaves? Posos means how many. So posus artus ekete, how many loaves have you? He's got another example down here, and he says, note especially Matthew 7:11, poso malon, this should be ho pater, it's an error there, it's not hey pater, humon, dose agatha, how much or by how much more will your father give good things? So the idea of how much there, with reference to how much, you see, is almost the idea they're using the dative. Okay. Then pelikos in the New Testament occurs only in exclamations. So pelikois, you mean gramasin egrapsa, with what large letters I have written you. So it's kind of an exclamatory statement. And pelikos meaning how great, you know, how great letters. And it was what large letters. It's modifying letters there, dative plural, so it's pelikois. And of course, it's declined. Pelikos and posos and poios, all three of those are normal adjectives as far as their declension is concerned. They're like kalos or something. They're not third declension ones, in other words. Whereas tis would be third declension type. Okay, then adverbs that are asking questions. Here we see the morpheme, a P on the front. There's a lot of these words that we've seen in other forms, but putting the P on the front will make them interrogative adverbs and make them asking questions. So, pu meaning where has a question, pothen meaning whence, pota meaning when, and post meaning how, all of them has questions. Posakis meaning how many times, and then t meaning why. Now, t is also just your neuter nominative and accusative singular form of tis. And so sometimes you have to kind of look at the context and decide which it is, whether it's meaning why or whether it's meaning what. And oftentimes those ideas are pretty close anyway. They're pretty similar to each other. To put something in neuter and get kind of a conceptual idea and so forth is pretty common. So I don't know if we'll read through all of these. I think they're pretty straightforward. Adverbs don't decline or anything, so you see what's happening. Now, the remark at the top of the next page deals with this relationship with T. The context enables us to tell when T should be rendered why and when it should be rendered what. The phrase dia T, why, on what account, is unambiguous. So there isn't any problem there. When you see dia T, it's literally through what. Through what. And that's where you get the idea of why. Through what, you see, through what, or on what grounds or for what reason is what you're really asking. And so our English word why covers that. Okay, then the last section deals with indirect questions. Now, indirect questions in English are introduced by the same interrogatives that are used in the direct questions. Who, what, when, where, etc. And also by whether and if. The tense of the verb in an English indirect question depends on the tense of the main verb. Okay, so looking at example here, direct question, they asked him, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? That would be a direct question. You have it in direct quotation marks, you see. They asked him, comma, and then in quotes, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? Now notice that they asked him is a past tense verb form, and then this question has a present tense verb form. The reason for that is that when you're dealing with a direct quotation, you're actually repeating the very thing that was said in that time frame. And so in the past, it was present to them. And so they're saying, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? Now, if you make this into an indirect question, then you're no longer going to be making a direct quotation, but you're going to be giving the information. And so they asked him whether it was lawful to heal on the Sabbath. Notice that our verb tense has changed in the indirect question from the direct question. It's changed from is to was. And this is just a peculiarity of English. It's just what English does with indirect questions. It's going to have the indirect question's verb indicated by the initial verb in the sentence. And of course, that's largely going to be determining whether the thing is a present ongoing thing or whether it was a past tense narrative or something of that nature. Now, the reason to make an emphasis on this is because we see an interesting difference in Greek on this score. In Greek, indirect questions may be also introduced by the same interrogatives as those used in direct questions, and in addition by a, whether, or if. In Greek, however, the tense of the verb in the indirect question is always the same as it would be if the question were direct. So, in a Greek sentence, the tense of the verb is going to be the same as it would be if it were a direct question. And that means that to translate it into English, we may have to make a change in the verb tense, just to make it follow the English pattern. Now look at the example here and you'll see what we mean. Epirotesan auton, a existin, tois sabbathin therapeusai. They asked him whether it was lawful to heal on the Sabbath. Now notice your verb form. Existin is a present verb form. So literally, it would be translated something like, they asked him whether it is lawful to heal on the Sabbath. In other words, they asked is still in the past tense, but the Greek verb and the indirect question is also in the present, just like the direct question would have been. And so, just take note of that when you see it. It's not that big of an issue. It's just something to watch so that you don't get confused and see a tense in the Greek and then wonder, you know, how should I translate this? They asked him whether it is lawful to heal on the Sabbath. It might be all right, understandable in English, but normally we would put it in the past tense. They asked him whether it was lawful to heal on the Sabbath and had the indirect question verb follow the main verb. Yes,
yeah,
Greg?
I noticed that the Sabbath there was in plural.
Mm-hmm.
In English, it's not rendered. Is that customary?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know if Tony has any light on that, but we're doing some work on the idea of the Sabbath and so forth in some of the grad classes for a particular problem. But literally, it is Sabbath, and to heal on the Sabbath. And I suppose we'd have to look into that just to see what idiomatic considerations there are. But aside from idiomatic considerations, it would probably be just the idea of healing on the Sabbath. Period. They had plenty. They had weekly Sabbaths. They had feast Sabbaths. They had sabbatical years, and so forth. There was a number of kinds of Sabbaths, and so you often see Sabbaths in plural in the New Testament, just because of that. The fact that they had the Sabbath concept showed up in a lot of different situations, and so they had all kinds of situations in which they'd have a Sabbath rest, usually associated with the yearly feasts and with the Sabbath day, the weekly Sabbath. Okay. And it may be plural just because Jesus did this more than once too. He healed on different Sabbaths. And you know, they're kind of looking at it from the standpoint, he's got this habit of healing on Sabbath days, you know. Okay. Classical Greek made use of special indirect interrogative pronouns, adjectives, and adverbs. For example, hostis for tis, hopos for pos, hopoios for poios. So there were in the classical Greek special forms using a ho on the front of it to indicate indirect interrogatives. And these occur with these meanings only very rarely in the New Testament Greek. There are a few other types of questions do occur, but these will be considered after the remaining moods of the verb have been discussed. So we're going to get to some other types of questions, and that's why I mentioned before, when we get to subjunctive and so forth, there'll be situations where we'll get into other types of question, you know, formats. But the direct, basic, simple question is done with the indicative mood. Okay, now, this classical Greek use apparently was eroding at the time of the Koine Greek, and they weren't making the same distinctions using the shorter forms, but once in a while you'll see those forms in the New Testament as well. Okay, questions, anyone, on that chapter? All right, then the next chapter here is relative clauses. And that's the last chapter we had before we got into, we left off at chapter 41, so we're almost up to where we were. This one also is deserving of a little bit more attention. These relative clauses are very, very important in Greek. Just like we saw with the participial phrases and how common they're used, relative clauses are also very commonly used in Greek. And we need to understand their function and be able to compare those with participial phrases. In fact, lots of times you'll find that a sentence could be stated in Greek either with a participle or with a relative clause. And we'll see examples of that a little bit later on here. And it's kind of interesting to note which is done when and so forth. Well, let's look first of all at these examples, section 305, to kind of see where we're headed. He gives us four sentences here. First, who is coming with a question mark. Second, we shall ask them who is coming with a question mark. C, we shall ask them who is coming, indirect question, even though there's no question mark there. And then the fourth one, this is the man who is coming. Now, the first, he goes on to say basically that these first three are all questions of one sort or another. Either a direct question or an indirect question and so forth. And they've all got certain types of intonation patterns and question ideas and so forth. And the word who is used in all four of these sentences. But the last one, the word who, has got a different function than it does in the first three. In the first three, it's always indicating a question of some sort, or at least a request for some information. In the last one, though, we see a different usage. And so near the bottom of this paragraph here on this page, in D, however, these same words do not express a question. Rather, they are descriptive of the man. So now we see this is the man who is coming, and we see a phrase that's describing the man. And who is introducing a phrase that's giving a description to the man. The structural difference between the clause who is coming as it appears in sentence C and as it appears in D may be seen from its transformational properties. Sentence C may be transformed easily into sentence B, and any indirect question may in a similar fashion be transformed into a direct one. Sentence D, however, cannot be transformed in this way. The clause who is coming is not, therefore, an indirect question. Sentence D can be represented as the equivalent of two sentences. This is the man, and the man is coming. You put those together, this is the man who is coming. So, sentence D2, just above here, is grammatically attached to sentence D1 by replacing the common term, the man, by who. In this function, who is said to be a relative pronoun, and the clause that introduces is said to be a relative clause. A relative clause is one, basically, that's giving some information relative to something else in the main clause. So somehow, a relative clause, you see, is always a slave to, or always attached to, or always points to something in the independent clause, something in the major part of the sentence. It won't stand all by itself, at least not with the way it's stated with the who there and so forth. You could split it up and make two independent sentences if you wanted to, like this is the man and the man is coming. But as they stand within a sentence and as you find them, the relative clause will not stand all by itself. Okay, now section 306. In English, we have, as we have just seen, the form who serves to introduce direct questions, indirect questions, the first fellow, okay? And relative clauses. New Testament Greek has two forms corresponding to the English who. Tis and hos. Tis, as we saw in lesson 39, is used to introduce direct or indirect questions. Hos is used to introduce relative clauses. So we have a different word for relative clauses than we do for interrogatives. So that makes it at least nicer to be able to recognize things in Greek. Accordingly, sentences A, B, and C would all appear in Greek as follows. The first three would all have tis in them, and the fourth one would have hos. You see that in boldface there. Now, section 307, the forms of the relative pronoun hos should be carefully distinguished from those of the definite article. And there's a reason for this, because your eye can make, you know, a mistake sometimes. And because the relative pronoun, at least in some of the forms, at least the nominative forms, look so much like the article, it's easy to make some mistakes along those lines. But there is a difference. No forms of the relative pronoun begin with tau, whereas a good percentage of your articles begin with tau. Now, admittedly, the nominative forms, masculine and feminine, have a rough breathing. They don't have a tau in the article, but all the rest of the forms have a tau. And so that's the difference. The relative pronoun doesn't have tau in any of the forms. And that all of them are accented. All of your relative pronouns are accented, whereas that's not the case with the article. The relative pronoun is declined as follows. So here's the paradigm on the top of the next page here, and this is the ending system is basically like what you've seen before in your first and second declension type adjective. And so that doesn't really present any problem. But notice that you have the rough breathing on all of the forms, and you have an accent on all of the forms. And the accent will be a circumflex in the dative and genitive forms and an acute everywhere else. So that's an easy way to remember them. So now you've got the whole paradigm memorized. All you need to do is put down your ending system for what you've seen before. And although do note that the neuter forms do not have the new again. It's just like autos, remember, you had auto. Here it's just ho for the neuter singular and the neuter nominative and accusative singular forms. But other than that, it's just like the endings you've already seen. So there isn't any problem as far as the declension is concerned. Now, section 308, the forms of hos correspond to English who, whom, whose, which, that, what. The context determines which English form should be used. The gender and number of a relative pronoun are the same as the gender and number of the noun or pronoun to which the relative noun refers. Relative pronoun refers. In each of the illustrated sentences below, this noun or pronoun called the antecedent of the relative is printed in boldface type. Now you see a relative pronoun is standing in for something else, and it's tying the part of the clause back to that something else. And whatever that something else is in terms of its gender and number, the relative pronoun is going to agree with that. That's how you tell that it's going back to that word. In other words, there's a concord rule involved here, such that the relative pronoun is going to agree in gender and number with its antecedent. Now, why doesn't it agree in case? Notice that case is omitted here. See, an adjective will agree with its noun in case, number, and gender. But here it's only in number and gender. Is there any reason for that? The second, we have to get... Right, exactly. A relative clause, you see, the function of this word in its own clause may be different than the function of the word that it's referring back to in the sentence was. The antecedent may be, say, an accusative case, but the relative is the subject of its clause, let's say, and it may be in the nominative case. In other words, those considerations are overriding the other. Although, what we will see is that there will be a tendency, and in this next section we'll talk about that, for the case of the pronoun to be attracted to the case of the antecedent, especially in certain circumstances. It doesn't happen all the time, but especially when you see the accusative case is what you would expect, and the antecedent was dative or genitive, there'll be an attraction back to that case of the antecedent. So that's an exception to this general trend. But generally, you're going to see, apart from this exception, you're going to see the relative pronoun have a case function that's appropriate to its function within its clause. Okay, that's all the time we have. We'll continue tomorrow with this. There won't be any formal assignment because we haven't gotten quite through this yet. But probably tomorrow... We'll get through, we'll for sure get through these relative clauses, and we'll be into the chapter that we're on. And this chapter on coordinating conjunctions is going to take a little while. It's mostly vocabulary, though. There's nothing really deep as far as grammar is concerned, but we'll run into lots of constructions and so forth and have to take some time to look at them. Okay. Is it by itself and weather, right? Yeah, we're
going to get
mm-hmm.
I don't know what he's dividing.